So for tonight's talk, last week I received an email from, email from somebody in Canada, in Toronto, and they sent me a little article by a quite a famous author, Sam Harris, about religion, especially about Buddhism, and mentioning Western Buddhism, and whether that has any future in our world and how it should actually be for the benefit of the Western societies. And he wanted to have some comments about that. So this evening I'm going to explore the topic of Western Buddhism. That's what people say. But first of all, this isn't Western Buddhism here. This is Southern Buddhism. We're not in the West. We are in the Deep South. But anyway, I have an interesting life, being a monk who has spent his first 9 years as a monk in Thailand and still travel around to so many places. And you know, there is no such thing as West or East or South or North anymore in our planet. You've all been traveling around. And wherever you go, whatever city in the world, even the most remote city, you can always get fish and chips. And everything else you could ever want in this world. Which just goes to show that sort of our world has become almost like a common culture. And it means that the jokes which I say over here on a Friday night are also heard in Sri Lanka, they're heard in the Islamic Republic of Iran, they're heard in United States and South America and Europe and even Africa. And people laugh at them wherever, well, they don't laugh, they sort of groan at them throughout the whole world. Which means to say that we do have a very much a common culture. So sometimes you ask yourself, is there really such a thing? Will there ever be such a thing as a Western form of one thing, an Eastern form of one thing, or an African form of one thing? Quite frankly, I think that those are just cultural conceits. Wherever I've gone, I see human beings are the same wherever you go. They laugh at the same things, and they cry at the same pain. There is a commonality of human beings, and I see that even with animals as well. The commonality which binds us all, which means that wherever you go, sort of the truth, the kindness, the compassion, the fear, you can see it in all beings. And so really there will never be any such thing as Western or Eastern Buddhism at all. But I think what this author was focusing on is what we might call like cultural Buddhism, or cultural religions, where some of the things which were culturally appropriate maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago are no longer appropriate. You know, and can sort of spirituality or religion jettison those things which are no longer useful? And of course, you find that yes, we can, and many people come to places like this because we do jettison those traditions which aren't really useful for our modern times. We don't have to light incense in our temple these days. The only reason why you had to light incense in Buddhist temples in ancient days, because people never washed or used deodorant. It meant that they ate too many beans. It meant that we could actually mask the smell, and candles would give light. And even many of the other things we would do in many of these places, like chanting, the only reason people chanted in those days was because they didn't have any books, and it was the chants by which we would remember these teachings. We'd repeat them to ourselves over and over and over again, and that became the chanting. But sometimes when people don't know what the purpose of these old cultural traditions are, sometimes we keep the cultural traditions and we forget what the sort of the real reason for these was. And I've done many, many times trying to get people to understand all these things, like even bowing. You don't have to bow when you come in here. You don't have to bow when you go out. You don't have to, you can if you want to, if you see its purpose. And remember how I've been teaching the purpose of bowing. The reason why people bow is because it exercises their stomach muscles so they don't get so fat. I should be bowing much more. But no, it is more than that. If you've heard me say that when I bow, the first time I bow is to virtue, second time is to peace, the third time is to compassion, because those are the things which I worship. Not a Buddha in the sense of a metal object like a god. We worship these things, these are qualities, because I respect those qualities. It's what the Buddha represents for me. So you worship things like virtue, peace and compassion. And the reason you do that, because it has an effect on you. Every time you bow, every time I bow, I remember those qualities. And because I put my head down and these things are above me, I'm raising their importance. I'm reminding myself, these things are really valuable. Which means psychologically it reinforces my commitment to virtue. It makes me look after peace much more. And try and create more peace in my own mind, in my life, in the world around me as much as I can. And also, the most important thing about compassion. I've been telling so many people, even recently, in any monastery, in any Buddhist society, in any community, the first rule, the most basic law, has to be kindness. Kindness rules. All other sort of ethics and laws, forgiveness, kindness, understanding one another and letting things go. That is the most important regulation. Now, understanding things like that, you practice things like that. You keep on bowing because you just love worshipping things like kindness, virtue and peace. So this is actually taking some of these cultures and not jettisoning them, not throwing them away, but making use of them. And even like the Buddha statue, it's a symbol of peace, which is in most people's gardens. So have a Buddha statue. I don't care if you're a Christian or Muslim or whatever. Why not have a Buddha statue? It's a symbol of peace. But you know, sometimes we have other symbols in our world. And one of the nice things about Buddhism in our modern world, I know that Sam Harris in his article said, so many religions are responsible for wars, therefore we should jettison all these religions, and then we may have some peace in this world. But, you know, no religion has a standing army. Governments do. So maybe it's governments. Actually, governments have caused more wars than any religion ever has. So maybe we should do away with all governments. Would that be a good idea? When I was in England recently, I saw all this land which was reserved for the Ministry of Defence. And I say, hang on, that's not the right description of the British Army and Navy and Air Force. It should be called the Ministry of Attack. So to give it the right name in places like UK or even in Australia, it should be the Defence, not the Defence Department, but the Attack Department, because that's what they do most of the time. Give it sort of a right name. But should we actually get rid of all the governments so there'd be no more wars? Should we get rid of all the religions? Or can't we sort of transform the religions? Or even better, now understand and know why Buddhism has always had a very good track record. Because it does have this ability from the very beginning to be tolerant. An example of that tolerance is the first time that I was invited to go and give talks in all sorts of places. Once I was giving a talk in Christchurch Grammar, you know, the nice school, it got these incredibly beautiful views of that in Christchurch Grammar over the Swan River. The first time I was invited to give a presentation at the school assembly, and being a Christian school, I was met outside by the principal and the chaplain, Frank Sheehan, is a good mate. And the principal looked at me and said, you know, you're a Buddhist monk. This is going to be a Christian ceremony at the beginning before you can give your talk. And because it's a Christian ceremony, the chaplain and I, we're going to bow to the altar of Jesus Christ. He said, but you're a Buddhist monk, you don't need to do that. And I saw my opportunity for being cheeky and making a point. I looked at the principal and I said, I demand my right to bow to that altar of Jesus. And he looked at me as if I was crazy, which maybe I am. But then I explained to him, look, I can bow to an altar of Jesus Christ because I can see something in that figure which I respect, and that's what I'm going to bow to. What I respect in that figure. Things which I don't respect, I'm not going to bow to that, but you can always find something to respect, that positive attitude, to see something good in anything. And I've done that all my life, to see something good. And when I see something good in a person who's committed a crime, when I see something good in someone who's cheated me, when I see something good in people who have abused me, then I can actually be in harmony with them. Then I can let it go. But if all I ever see is the things which they've done wrong, the bad, the evil part of them, that's where we have the disharmony, the lack of peace, and from that we get the wars and all the other sort of stuff which happens in life. Now this is such an important part of my understanding of Buddhism. It can create harmony and peace with anybody. One of the things which I loved about Buddhism was that it never rejected anybody. And that's why, whether you're gays, lesbians, transgenders, old, young, whoever you are, crazy or smart, I don't care who you are, we're so desperate in our Buddhist society, we don't invite anybody in. It's not being desperate. What it is, have you ever been rejected? Have you ever feel diminished because somebody has regarded you as something lesser and you're not allowed in? That's just a terrible, horrible feeling. And I've experienced that, being rejected, expelled. That's why, because we allowed women fully in to the Sangha here in Perth, something you should all be proud of, that somebody once, they wrote me, I was expelled from my monastery in which I grew up, which is too cultural. It hasn't really grown and understood real Buddhism. Somebody sent me this wonderful poem. If I can remember it now. Heretic Rebel. That's one line of it. What's the first line? That's right. I'm just trying to get that first line back in there. So anyway, the first line went something like, A heretic rebel, they shut me out. They shut me out. Heretic rebel, a thing to flout. But love and wisdom had the power to win. That's right, that's right. They drew a circle which shut me out. This is how it starts. They drew a circle which shut me out. Heretic rebel, one to flout. But love and wisdom had the wit to win. I drew a circle which pulled them in. Because this is what happens. We drew circles. This is us and the others. If you're a fundamentalist Buddhist, it's us and those Christians and those Muslims and those atheists and those people who can't come into my church or my temple or can't come into my heart. And that is something which doesn't make any sense to me. The whole part of being a Buddhist or being a spiritual person is actually expanding your circle. So more people can be included. More things can be included. I did this as a meditation. I taught this as a meditation many years ago. I just remember it now. I asked people when they started meditating to imagine a circle. And inside that circle are all the people you love and care for and respect. Your friends and loved ones, and also those things about life you really love and respect, and which you're very happy with. And on the edge of the circle is the things which are sort of irritating sometimes, but you love them. And it may be sort of your mother-in-law. But she's your mother-in-law, she's okay. Sometimes a bit irritating. And sometimes things in life, like politics, or your your football team always losing. Yeah, and that's a bit irritating. So these are the things outside the circle which you don't like all that much, but they're not that bad. And the further away you go outside of the circle, the more you find it hard to bear. People you just can't stand. Things in life which really irritate you, the further you go out, the more you hate them. And when you actually divide your world with people and things and experiences like that, you may have things like death, sickness, you know, banks, whatever. But the more further they are out, the more you hate them. And the idea is to expand your circle. Imagine it just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So first of all, you include into your circle people who, just on the edge, you don't really like them, but they're not that bad. Experiences in life which are difficult, going to work on a Monday morning, but it's not that bad. You know, doing examinations in school, yeah, but it's not that bad. Whatever it is, homework, you expand to start liking them. And once you start expanding your circle, it's not that hard to keep it expanding and expanding and expanding until things about life, old age, disappointments, you can start including those things in as well. And people who once irritated you, you start to pull them inside as well. Until eventually, the spiritual path of enlightenment is having a circle which is so wide, everything and everyone is allowed inside. No one is rejected. Love and wisdom had the wit to win. We drew a circle which pulled them in. Christians, Muslims, atheists, whoever it is, Collingwood supporters, they can all come in. Now that is something which you can see is creating harmony and peace in our world. And that is the sort of thing which religions should really be practicing. So that's why I took that opportunity to the principal at Christchurch Grammar to say, I can see things which I respect. I can bring you in. We can all come in. Now that's not that hard to do that. And then all these wars and conflict between people, we can just move beyond. Which means that actually that where he was saying as a religion is the cause of these problems, I keep on saying it's because when people don't understand their religion, that's when there is these conflicts. To understand this about why it is that it's not religions is the cause of conflicts in this world, but people who don't understand their religions. I wrote a story in the Open the Door of Your Heart, which you know, should be included right now, the story of the old man and the violin. It's a wonderful story to tell your friends. It's a story of an old man who lived in way up in the mountains in a very simple village, who worked his butt off to make enough money to send his kids to school, a good school, and then eventually to university. Like many parents sacrifice so much for their kids, and this was one such father, take on extra work just so his kids could get a good education. And they all did very well at school. They went to university, they got jobs as doctors, accountants, business people, and of course they moved to the big city. And once they got themselves established, married with houses, they thought, why don't we invite our father to the city for the first time, which they did. So here was a man who'd never been in a big city before in his life. And he saw things in a city which you don't see up in the mountains in simple villages. But one thing which took his attention was one day he was walking along the street with one of his sons. And he heard the worst sound in the whole world. He never ever heard such an awful noise in his whole life. But he was curious enough to find out what that noise was. He followed it to its source. In the back room of a house, he saw a young boy playing a violin. Of course, the boy was only a student, just learning. just the first lessons of violin, and the noise was so much screeches and scrapes, like a cat being tortured, that he didn't ever want to hear such a sound ever again. But the second day, I don't know why I said a cat being tortured, but I think it evokes the sort of sound which happens when you try and play a violin and you don't know what you're doing. The second day, in a different part of town, he heard a beautiful sound. It's so thrilling and peaceful and charming. He followed that to its source. And I'm sure you've all run ahead of me. He found an old woman playing exactly the same type of violin. And he realized it was not the violin's fault. It was that the boy had not yet learned how to play the instrument. But once he saw a maestro, this old woman who had been playing that violin all her life, saw her play it. It was one of the sweetest sounds in the whole world. And he realized it's not the fault of religions. It's that people haven't learned how to play their religion well yet. Because if ever you see a maestro, and I have seen maestros of Christianity, of Islam, I've seen maestros of Judaism, of Hinduism, and of course Buddhism, and they always play so sweetly. And you know, it's so easy to get on together. Which brings me to the last part of that story. The next day, in a different part of town, this old man from the mountains heard the sweetest sound he'd ever heard in his whole life. It was more beautiful than the sound of the mountain stream after a heavy rainstorm. It's more beautiful than the sound of the birds in the early morning, or even the sound of the wind rustling the leaves of the forest. It was the most beautiful sound in his whole life. If you haven't heard this story before, have a think. What do you think that sound was? The answer was an orchestra. It was the most beautiful sound for two reasons. First, every member of that orchestra was a maestro of their instrument. They'd been practicing for years and years and years. So they had mastered the instrument they were playing. And secondly, they'd all learned how to play in harmony together. And he thought, what a wonderful world that would be. If first of all people learned their religion, their spirituality, learned it well until they were maestros of their faith, and then, most important of all, learn how to pray together in harmony. What a beautiful world that would be. And that is the possibility. That's what real religions should be working towards. And that's certainly what Buddhism worked towards, not in modern days, but even in the very old days. Many people just misunderstand. They think the monks and nuns you have here are just modern monks and nuns. Ajahn Brahm tells jokes. Traditional monks aren't supposed to tell jokes. Ajahn Brahm sometimes says the shit word. Oops, now I did it again. Traditional monks aren't supposed to say that. But you know, that tradition is cultural. Because one of the things about, you know, being educated not as a Buddhist, but, you know, growing up in a Western world where you really get into educating yourself and also asking questions and challenging, and we all found out this is amazing. This is actually how the Buddha taught. Because we have access to all these old texts. And you find, yes, that is actually how they really did it in the old days. Somehow or other, over the passage of 2,600 years, you know, from the time of the Buddha till now, somehow or other, we've actually lost, you know, the heart of that spirituality. We've had all of these customs and rituals, and not being able to laugh, and not being able to tell jokes, and not being able to, you know, say sort of common words like shit or whatever else it is you say. You've lost that. And sometimes you think that even like, I'm going to get into trouble for this, but I don't care. I'm always into trouble. Even like someone like a Jesus. If he was going to be popular, if he was going to actually connect with people, he would have said the ship word or whatever it was which was used in Palestine in those days. Of course they would, simply because this was the language of the people, and obviously had some connection, a great connection, otherwise there wouldn't be sort of the residues 2,000 years afterwards. There has to be something there. And that degree of connecting with real life, with real people, with real problems, now that is original religion, spirituality. The trouble is, as soon as you do one thing, everybody tends to imitate and do the same. We just make a religion out of these, we make a sort of a dogma rather than a religion out of all of these things. I remember my teacher, Ajahn Chah, just before he stopped teaching, he would give the simile of the crab with a bad leg. And the mother crab had a bad leg and had about 6 or 7 babies. And the mother crab said, look, I've got a bad leg. That's why I limp. Please don't you limp. And of course, all the baby crabs, they just follow the mother. Mother limps, so all the babies limp as well. Just like, a Jesus or a Buddha would have some idiosyncrasies. He said, no, just take the real message. Don't take the sort of the container and the sort of the idiosyncrasies. And what do people do? They just follow all the idiosyncrasies. So my idiosyncrasies are to tell jokes. And so now all the other monks and nuns who come here, they have to tell a joke too. That's my idiosyncrasy. It's not them. And the Christmas joke, if you haven't heard it... I'm going to get into trouble for this as well. I tried it on our admin officer earlier, so he groaned, so it's up to standard. About 3 people died just on Christmas Eve. So when they appeared in heaven, they had to pass a test to go in. And the test was, you have to show us something to do with Christmas, because it's Christmas Eve. So the first person thought, what can I show? Something to do with Christmas. And he got out his cigarette lighter. He lit it and said, Christmas candle. It's a candle. Christmas candle. They said, okay, you can go in. And the next person got out their car keys. Jingle bells, jingle, jingle, jingle. Okay, fair enough. And the third person took out of his pocket a pair of ladies' underwear. He said, what's that? I said, it's carols. You see, now that's my idiosyncrasy. And we hope we're not going to start a religion where every priest has to tell bad jokes. But it's actually just the heart of this. Now that is actually what the traditional religion really was. It's just the compassion, the kindness, the respect for the humanity of the people in front of you. Giving sort of teachings which actually work. Because the whole point of a religion, from the time of all religions, from this one to others, the religion or the spirituality, whatever you wish to call it, which will grow and take off in this world, is a religion of fun. Because people love to have a religion which takes away the suffering of life. Life is already just too hard. Too difficult, just surviving with all the problems, rushing around, trying to make ends meet, whatever else you have to do in life, dealing with the problems of kids misbehaving, or husbands misbehaving, or wives nagging, or whatever, all these problems which are so common. I always say this, when I first started off here, and one person came and asked a problem of me, I thought it was really interesting. The next person wanted some counselling from me. I listened to them and I said, I've heard that before. The next person, here we go again. Sometimes you think that your problems are unique. They're not. They're everybody's problems. Lack of feeling respected, accepted, afraid of rejection, afraid of pain. Just what you want to be. Accepted, included into that circle. Most importantly, included into your own circle. To include yourself into your own heart. These are little things which are common to all people. So that's what we talk about. I always notice with laughter, when you laugh, you're all included. you know, excluded anymore. That's why laughter, sharing a joke, is a wonderful sense of sharing, which creates harmony in any community. I've done that deliberately. I was just reflecting today, we were messing around in our monastery with all our monks, laughing and cracking stupid jokes. You know, that's an important part of why, if you ever go to Bodhinyana Monastery, it's got a very good atmosphere there. It's got a very good atmosphere, simply because we laugh together. And we laugh so much, we haven't got time to criticize one another and point out each other's faults, which are there anyway. How important is that laughter as a spiritual path? That's why, you know, the type of Buddhism which we teach here, you know, the Hahayana path, as I said, I think, last week, combining everything. Now, that's an important path. And if there's more laughter, imagine if there was more laughter in Islam. Where would the terrorists be, or the Taliban be, if they, you know, laugh a bit more? Well, what's that joke about the terrorist camp? The camp training terrorists. The instructor brought all his disciples in and said, come on, this is the next lesson. Stand around me. They stand around me. Now, please listen very carefully, because I'm only going to say this once. This is the suicide belt. I'm only going to tell you this once. This is how it works. Okay, you get it. Very good. So we're going to have a little bit of laughter and fun. It's not just laughter and fun, which is one of the great ways of actually teaching. To tell a story, to tell something with a meaning in such a way that we're laughing at ourselves and seeing the silliness of ourselves. Which means we don't take ourselves so seriously. All anger, all ill will, all rage comes from taking life far too seriously. And just rejecting someone, rejecting someone's behavior, rejecting someone because of the way they look, rejecting whatever. You know, when you laugh, you make fun, you don't take life so seriously. You know how much more you can accept of people and of yourself and of life? That's why that rejecting, that ill will, that anger, that guilt, that fear, which is rejecting the future, rejecting the past, or rejecting the present moment. This is actually what the job of religion should be, to overcome. Even rejecting the things which you really don't like in life, like pain, suffering. It's amazing just how when you can crack a joke, a lot of the pain disappears. I still remember, she's not here this evening, there's one lady, I think she was a secretary once, and a poor girl had to have a hysterectomy. And she was such a fit girl, that was the first time she ever went to hospital, and I said she could remember. And so she gave me a call, can you come to visit me? So I remember visiting, I think, in King Edward Hospital. When I went in there into the ward, she said, please, Ajahn Brahm, don't tell me any jokes. I've got this big scar, and every time I laugh, even breathe, it really hurts. But with the best will, with all my compassion, I couldn't help myself. So please do not invite me in if you've had a hysterectomy. I'm the last person you should get to visit you. But on the other occasion, I remember when going to the old the hospice, which was over in Shenton Park. Remember the old hospice, which for some stupid reason the government shut down. It was a crazy thing to do. But I remember going to that hospice. I mean, Jenny, you worked there before. Many people from here worked or volunteered there. I remember going to the hospice because there was an Australian girl. She'd become a Tibetan nun. Didn't care, Tibetan nun, Theravada nun, Chinese nun. I don't care. You know, you're a Buddhist or you're anybody. You're still my friend. So I went over to see her because she called me. She said she thought she was dying. It's amazing. When people say that, I really take that seriously, because you know when you're going to die. She said she thinks she's dying a couple of days, she said, and she was bang on. 2 days later, she was dead. So she called me, said, can you come and visit me? I'm going to go soon. So when I heard that, I dropped everything, got in a car, and went all the way from Serpentine to Shenton Park, about an hour and a half in the traffic. And when I got there, you can't just barge into somebody's room in a hospice. You had to go and check in with a duty nurse. And this duty nurse, she was, you know, like a Maggie Thatcher in a nurse's outfit. She was so fierce. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I've come to see this nun." "Sorry, you cannot see her." I said, "Look, why not? I've just come all the way. I don't care where you've come from. She's given explicit orders. She doesn't want any visitors." "But she just rang me a few moments ago." "I don't care. We have to respect our patient's wishes." "But look, she..." And this nurse was so upset and angry at me. She looked at me, glared, said, "Come with me." So I followed her. We went to the patient's room. And on the outside was this big sheet of paper. Absolutely no visitors. And this nurse, she glowered at me, said, "See?" And I looked, this is actually a true story. On the bottom, in small print, were the three words, "Except Ajahn Brahm." I couldn't help myself. I looked at that nurse and said, "See?" And I really enjoyed that. I'm just expressing their karma for being nasty to me. I'll be nasty back. Maybe I shouldn't have done that, but it was fun. But when I went inside, I just asked this nurse, I said, "Why did you say that? Why did you say no visitors except for me?" He said, "Because you're the only one who comes in here and laughs and treats me like a human being, not a sick person." I always remember that. That taught me how when you go and visit a sick person, don't visit the sickness, visit the person. They get enough of people asking them, "How do you feel today? Are you feeling better? How many days are you going to spend in this place?" Rah, rah, rah. That's what doctors and nurses are supposed to do. You're supposed to give them another part of life. Now talk about the latest stroke, anything. The cricket, the government, what's on the TV, what you know your neighbour is doing, anything. So she just asked me, "What's the latest joke?" So we spent about half an hour on deep counselling, just telling jokes to each other. Because that's really what she needed, what she wanted. Just want, you know, to be with a friend and be treated like a human being, not like someone who's dying. She told me that all these people who come in, they see me, because you know, when you're dying, she had a bad cancer. Now she's losing all her weight, looking like some skeleton, just with a covering of skin. See, when people see me, they get so upset and depressed. "Oh, you look terrible." And that doesn't help me one bit. Having to deal with their emotional problems. And I've got enough emotional problems of myself. So always remember just the importance of just that kindness. And also that wisdom. And that's one of the great things spirituality gave from the very beginning, especially something like Buddhism. To be able to, they keep saying these days, to think outside the box. That's one of the reasons you come here, to get all these thinkings outside the box. And sometimes people say, "Where do you get all these stories from? All these ideas from? All this wisdom from?" I get all this wisdom by just not following what you follow. Challenging. Seeing things from a different way. Meditation is a great way of doing that. Because when you meditate, you clear your mind of all the past, so you can see things in weird ways. New ways. And also, it gives you that sense of joy, even in the most difficult of situations. Always see a positive side to it. So that's one of the reasons why modern Buddhism and old Buddhism have always worked. They've gone to the heart of it, the human heart of life. They want to have fun, but also to understand, have meaning. And it's not just like fun, fun. You know, there's a very deep joy, which sometimes, well, look, let's use the simile of when you listen to music. You get inspired. Why do you get inspired by listening to powerful music? It just takes you to another place. A place which is beyond, you know, the mundane, the ordinary concerns of life. Just something which is really powerful and moving. The same time when you see a great act of kindness or a great act of love, something which really moves you. You know that story which was going the rounds about that policeman in New York who gave a pair of boots to a homeless man. Many of you saw that was beautiful. That was like the same feeling I get when I used to listen to great music. The same feeling you get after a really nice meditation. Beauty. And that's the other part of what spirituality is supposed to evoke. The sense of beauty. The beauty of human beings coming together in a center like this from all different places. A lot of you with enormous problems. Some of you just been coming here for years, still as stupid as when you first came 25 years ago. But I love you like that. I wouldn't want you to be any different. There's some sense of beauty there, of people being accepted for who they are. The beauty of having Santa Claus with a kangaroo sitting in front of a monk. Sort of crazy, kooky. But isn't there something lovely about that? That acceptance of the silliness of life and its celebration. And with all the difficulties and problems you have, you come here and realize you can have a different perspective. You know that sometimes the problems of life, this is a simile, classic Buddhist simile. How big is my hand? How big is my hand? It's so big right now I can't see any of you. All the 300, 400 people in this room and all the life outside, I can't see anything, only my hand. Is it my hand's fault? Is it my hand too big? No, that's not the problem. I'm holding it too close to me. It's just perspective, that's all. Attitude. When I hold my hand where it belongs, at the end of my arm, it hasn't got smaller. The hand is exactly the same size, but now I've got it in perspective. My hand is there, but I can also see each one of you. I can see the beautiful lights outside. This is the simile of why we suffer. We take a problem, we hold it so close to us, that's all we can see. And the job of religion, spirituality, is to put it where it belongs, at the end of your arm. You're not getting rid of the problem. It's still there, the hand is still there, the same size. But you're putting it in a perspective, the two bad bricks in the wall story. You see it as it truly is, and it's not a big problem anymore. It's just a hand. It's just a mother dying. It's just a cancer in your body. It's just being bankrupt. So what? Ajahn Brahm's got no money either. You can always come to our monastery for a free food package. You see what the real problem is? Now you lost your job. You've gone to prison because something's happened to you. That's the hand at the end of the arm. If you keep it in the right perspective, it's not suffering anymore. It's just this amazing part of your life. Put it up here. It's really painful. So that is the sort of similes which actually change human beings. Which actually, it's not trying to wave a magic wand and get rid of the problems which each one of you face in life. It's actually giving them perspective. And when you give them perspective, the problem's solved. Yeah, it's just a bit of disappointment, it's a bit of an illness, it's a bit of tragedy in the life. But there's so much more to life. Give it that perspective. There's a great sense of beauty. Beauty even where people think there was just suffering. What was that story that just comes to mind? There was this person who volunteered to do some social service in a poor country suffering from famine. And they volunteered to do anything. They weren't qualified as a doctor or a nurse, just to help. So they went to this refugee camp somewhere in Africa during a very severe famine. And they were given the job of going outside the fence every morning with a number. And that was a number of people who would be allowed into that refugee camp that day. Because they only had enough food and medicines for a certain number. Never enough. And she was actually playing God. That was her job. Because the ones who would be invited inside would live. The ones who couldn't come in would die in the next 24 hours. And she said that that was not a difficult job. But one of the most inspiring things of her life. She said, these refugees suffering from famine, they never said, take me, take me. They're always saying, take her. She's a mother with a kid. Take someone else. In such difficult situations, real matters of life and death, the people who came to the refugee camp were so inspiring in their conduct and their lack of selfishness. She realized there was something beautiful in those human beings. Even though they were to die, they would die with grace, with beauty. And it gave her the sense of hope. Even in such desperate situations, people would not think of themselves, would have compassion and selflessness and generosity. So that's what made what other people thought would be so traumatic, beautiful. And part of religion. Actually, afterwards, when she spent 6 months, after that she went back to her job, which was in the government service. See, that was traumatic. That wasn't inspiring. Simply because people were selfish. They lost their generosity. There was no beauty left. She found beauty in the most interesting of places, the most unexpected of places. And that's part of spirituality of religion. To see beauty where you will never ever expect it. And that beauty, that sort of inspiration, the same feeling you get with, say, music, or seeing a sunset, seeing a kid born, seeing kids play together. That is that inspiration of beauty, which will always give religion a place in this world. That is at the heart of all of this. Because without inspiration, where will we ever be? Yeah, we can replace religion with science, but science is so dull. Does science really ever inspire you? Yeah, it does actually make our TVs and computers work. Yeah, it does send us, you know, over into space or wherever. But how often does it really inspire? Like life can inspire, and like religion can point out. So that is why spirituality will always have a place. And it's not just Western Buddhism. It's not just Eastern Christianity. This is a world culture. What it really is these religions finally understanding what they should be doing and how they should be practicing until they can play their religions like a maestro can play a violin. They can play like Jimi Hendrix could play that guitar. Oh, he was so inspiring when I was very young. Now that is what the religion is all about. So I think it will always have a place. As long as people take away all the wrappings and actually go back to the original. And the original was always inclusive. There were nuns in the time of the Buddha. Gays and lesbians were accepted in India at that time. They were not rejected. For those of you who want to know, I think Lord Macaulay, one of the viceroys of India, he actually wrote in the law, changing the culture of India to exclude gays as abnormal. That came from the British Raj. And I think the Indian government is now changing the law back. The Indian government. They realize this was a law imposed by Westerners over 100 years ago. Nothing to do with Indian culture. They're always accepted. Except again. So this, I think, if you really go back far enough, you find that many of those religions in the early forms were the pure ones. Somehow or other, we've added so many cultural and really weird ideas onto these which don't belong. Religion should be beautiful, inspiring, meaningful, fun, bringing people together. And I will finish with a quote from the Buddha. He said, you will know it's the truth, that it's the teachings of the Buddha, if it does lead to harmony, to peace, to freedom. If it doesn't, these are not Buddhism. That's a quote from the Buddha. His advice he gave to the first Buddhist nun and also to this monk Upali. Thank you for listening. Very good. So now we have the questions, the comments, the complaints about the jokes. So any questions from Perth, first of all, for the audience here? Okay, we're going to get the overseas ones. Here we go. First of all, this is a question from the Islamic Republic of Iran saying there is a fatwa on you now, Ajahn Mahfouz. No, there's not. The second is from the Pope. I loved your joke about camels. Unfortunately, that's not here either. I'm making these up. Apparently, there's no relevant web-based question today. Wow, I've brought people into silence. So, I know that sometimes people keep asking, is Buddhism really a religion? You know my answer? Buddhism is a religion. For tax purposes, anyway. So I said that on Philip Adams' show, he liked that one. So yeah, I think what we're doing, and what we should always be doing, we're changing the meaning of the word religion. Because religion has all these ideas of meanings of about dividing people, have this sect and that sect and this cult, and always fighting each other and never going to each other's churches or mosques. We do that. I mean, it was just last month we were over in the Benedictine Abbey at New Norcia, because they're good mates of us. We go right inside, and they come to our monastery every now and again. One of my proudest of achievements. This was according to John Shepherd. He's the dean of St. George's Cathedral. He said that I was the first non-Christian in 2,000 years ever to give the sermon on a Sunday Mass. That's a nice thing to put in your CV. And many of you, remember some of you were there at that time? It was a really great day because he invited me to do a sermon at St. George's Cathedral on a Sunday as part of the Mass. And I went in there. Many of you were there as well. And many of the Christians who usually go to that place were there as well. It was packed. I mean, it really was. No standing room only. You know, even if Michael Jackson was there, it wouldn't have got more people in. And there were people outside, about two or three people, saying the dean is going to burn in hell for allowing these Buddhists into the sacred site of the church. And I remember that this guy actually just managed to force his way in and started haranguing. And then they threw him out. And all that was left in there was people. And as I looked, I remember I could not know who was a Buddhist, who was a Christian. And I didn't give a damn. Just people, shoulder to shoulder, enjoying a nice talk, having harmony, laughing at some funny stories, and being together. So what a wonderful sign that was. That is what religion is, which brings harmony, peace, kindness, and beauty to our world. And it's there. Just we need to notice it every now and again. So that was a nice achievement, doing that. Also, I was give a talk, you know, very often at Carmel School, that's a Jewish school. I always remember just going to, because you're always well connected these days, going to the first ordination of Kay Goldsworthy. She was the first Anglican bishop, female, in Australia. I think we beat New Zealand by a couple of months. So I remember I was invited to the ordination of the first female bishop in the Anglican Church. They tried to ban that in the UK recently. And there I was sitting next to the old Abbot Placid, the Benedictine monk, and the head of the Uniting Church, the three of us in the other religions pew at St. George's Cathedral. And know what we did? Because it was 2 hours, this ordination. That's really a long time. And they didn't have as many jokes as you get here in Nolamara, so I was getting so bored. This is absolutely true. I talked to Abbot Placid, we started telling jokes to each other. And then the Uniting Church, the head of the Uniting Church, the moderator, he joined in as well. I think it was a she. So I had these three naughty boys, or two naughty boys and a naughty girl, in church telling jokes at each other while they were doing the ordination. It was crazy. Well, that was a wonderful thing, to, you know, these different religions uniting Catholic and Buddhist, having a great time in an ordination of an Anglican. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that inspiring? Isn't that what religion should be all about? So I think it's wonderful if you come and take these messages out. It's Christmas now. Celebrate Christmas. Most religious people, they celebrate Christmas, they celebrate Eid, that's the Islamic holiday, Hanukkah, any reason for a happy time. Why not? Even Ajahn Chah would always say, he called it Buddhamas Day. I don't care what you call it. Anything which is love and peace to all human beings and animals too. Isn't that a wonderful sentiment? I can celebrate that. So once we told my teacher Ajahn Chah what Christmas was, oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, you can celebrate it too. So this is why we celebrate these things. Why in the Buddhist temple we have Father Christmas sitting right next to me. And you are very welcome, Santa. Anyone got any question yet? Okay, I think you just want another joke. Okay, so let's now pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go and do what we need to do.
Sati Pano Bhagavato.